This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore. And before we get started this week, I just want to read a listener email. We got a very nice listener email from Brad Alexander. He had some thoughts on the show that we're just going to read out to you guys. So here's what Brad has to say. Awesome show, gents. I'm really enjoying the interesting angles from which you come at TOS after all these years. The previous host had great discussions, and while refreshing to hear individuals' takes on the nuances of an episode. However, and especially as a listener to Mission Log, sometimes the episode analysis feel kind of redundant. But several of the last shows have shown some real genius in the topic areas, like the Toys of Star Trek. Well, thank you. That was my idea.
Okay, Zach, just read it.
And another one was the space stations. That was your idea, Ken. So he gives us it's both credit. But keep up the good show ideas. Well, definitely. And this is a team effort. Me and Ken, I mean, we don't like have a schedule or anything, but we do just, you know, kind of, hey, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? And it's all just a good partnership here. But he goes on to say, by the way, the Defiant from Deep Space Nine is my favorite starship. Referencing our starship discussions. And then Brad has some more to say. He says, Ken, it's nice to see someone on Standard Orbit who can say Kirk is my captain. I'm about 4 years older than you are, and while Kirk is indeed my captain, my favorite series is definitely Deep Space Nine. The storytelling was amazing. In fact, that might be an interesting series. Comparison of the captains. Of course, you would have to have hosts from the different shows on. I think that would be a great series of round tables. Well, we were put that in the idea bank there, Brad. And finally, I wanted to tell the chief, thanks for your service, and thanks for making it the entire career. I was Army and only made it 8 years. One of you said something on a previous show about doing it differently if you had to do it all over again. At one point, I thought I would. While I was in the Army, I found my love of submarines and submarine warfare. Bet you can't guess what TOS episode is consistently in my top five. Well, I bet we can. And now that I am in this stage of my life, however, I wouldn't give up the 30 years married to my bride or the kids and granddaughters for all the tea in China. Anyway, thanks for the effort on Standard Orbit. Unfortunately, I dropped Facebook like a bad habit almost 5 years ago. You're probably better off for it. Probably much more productive person than we are, Brad.
I think so.
Or else I would probably spend all my time on the Babel conference. The one thing I ask is that you not forget we Luddies out there that use email. Thanks, Brad. Well, you're not forgotten, Brad. And thank you so much for those kind words, man. That's why we do this. You know, we're sitting here, we're talking out into the void, and whenever we get something back, it's always a very encouraging feeling. So
yeah, we have great listeners, and a lot of people have been getting more and more engaged, and we've been getting a lot more feedback, just, you know, some IMs here and there, and then of course, you know, all the nice comments that on the Babel conference and the great discussions. I think there's two things going on that have made this a lot of fun. One, you know, Zach and I are trying to put a very different lens on the show, and we come up with these ideas, and not all of them hit. We know that too, but you know what? At least we're willing to take a chance. Two, we keep it light, right? We like to keep Star Trek fun. That doesn't mean we won't talk about a controversial subject from time to time, but I think, you know, for us, this is our escape, and we're hoping that for all of you that get to listen every Monday morning on your commutes in and so forth, that it has that right amount of energy, that right amount of fun that you can get into it. It's not too heavy. And like I said, we're not afraid to go there every once in a while, but you know, what is Star Trek? It's entertainment. We love it, and we love doing this podcast, and we love the feedback, both good and bad, and what things we could do better, too. But I'll tell you, Brad, getting that note really meant a lot. I remember the second I read it and reaching out to Zach, I was like, did you read that? I mean, that was really something. And it just, you know, it's nice to hear that when people say, hey, you know, you make it fun, you do this. I think it's good for you guys to hear, too. Hey, you make it nice for us when we get that kind of feedback. It really feels good. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and don't be a stranger, Brad, or anybody else out there who doesn't have Facebook, as you mentioned. You know, I know we're always talking about the Babel Conference, and we love the Babel Conference, but you know, a lot of people aren't on Facebook and aren't participants there. So yeah, feel free to email us in and, you know, and be part of the show. We love it. So,
absolutely.
Well, this week, our subject, moving on to that, is, you know, the Enterprise, the Star Trek Origins. We're getting back into that and to, you know, where all these things came from, right? So in 1964, Gene Roddenberry was pitching a show that featured a starship of humans exploring the galaxy aboard the USS Yorktown under the command of Captain Robert April as a, quote, wagon train to the stars. So, and as it continued to get flushed out, the ship's name, as well as their captain's name, changed a couple times, right? but the ship itself changed the USS Enterprise and the captain to Captain Christopher Pike.
Yeah, you know, for all of us that love Star Trek and we consider the Enterprise to be a character and a main character for a bunch of the different series, it was interesting how they came up with that name. So I started to do some research and say, okay, how did they come up with the name? You know, and it's all speculative. So when Zach and I were talking about a subject, it's like, okay, let's go back to that timeline. Let's take a look at it. What have could have been some of the key factors, and what was it about the Enterprise, right? Because if you think about the timing of the show launch, it was less than 20 years after the end of World War II. Most, if not all, the main producers and writers were veterans of the war. And back then, generals, admirals, and even the ships were followed closely by the press, and they were celebrities within themselves, right? Think about it, right? Everybody knows Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur. Probably lesser known on the Navy side was Admiral Nimitz, but Admiral Bull Halsey, Raymond Spruance, you know, a lot of names. And that kind of went along with that era. I mean, back then, these military heroes, the folks that literally won the war, would sign autographs and people would write to them all the time. And then they also followed very closely, you know, campaigns and ships. And at that timeline, too, you know, the first name, right, that Roddenberry proposed was the Yorktown. And aside from a famous revolutionary battle, it was also a famous ship, actually two ships during World War II. And the first one was involved in the first naval campaign either, where the two sides fought a battle, but neither ship sighted each other. It was all fought by aircraft in the Battle of the Coral Sea. And then the Yorktown, which was heavily damaged in that battle, made it back to Pearl Harbor. And within 80 hours, it was turned around to go fight the Battle of Midway, which it eventually sunk during that battle. And a ship, just like when Captain Kirk and the team, right, in Star Trek IV, you know, they come back. There was a new ship being built, and they changed the name of the Enterprise. Well, there was another carrier being built, and in order to honor the Yorktown service, they immediately changed the name back to Yorktown. So Yorktown was, back then anyway, very popular, well-known. It is sitting in Charlestown Harbor today as a monument, the second one, obviously. The first one was recently filmed undersea. The same folks that found the Titanic found the Yorktown, which is kind of interesting. So I think that may have been why that was such a big play. It wasn't that it was just the last battle of the American Revolutionary War. I think it really focused on that ship. And it was, like I said, a very famous ship. But it was also a very American name, right? It wasn't something that outside of the U.S. people would really know that name. And that's kind of where I'm guessing why the Yorktown was set aside.
Yeah, Ken, I'm thinking for a, quote, United Earth ship, Yorktown might have been too exclusively American. So do you think that was really the main reason why they changed the name of the ship to Enterprise?
I'm thinking, you know, it's all speculation, but in all the research that we looked at, I believe Enterprise was more appropriate and appealing, but there's some big reasons why. During World War II, there was a USS Enterprise, and she was number six. She was the sixth aircraft carrier ever built, and she was designated CV. And in the Navy, ships have designations, right? If you're a destroyer, you're a DD. If you're a guided missile destroyer, you're a DDG. If you're an aircraft carrier, you're a CV. The C for carrier, and V stands for air wing.
Oh, okay. I always thought it was vehicle, but what do I know? So
that's okay. Yeah, but it stands for E-wing. So any air squadrons in the Navy start with the letter V. So if it's an attack squadron, you'll see VA for air wing attack, or VB for bombers or fighter bombers, or they even have VQ squadrons. I don't remember what the Q stands for, but those Q squadrons were like patrol planes, spy planes, things along those lines. Yeah, I know. Back to Star Trek, Ken. Sorry, folks. So I thought it'd be interesting, if you'd like, Zach, to kind of talk about the history of the Enterprise, what made it such a famous ship, and some of the parallels with the show Star Trek, and why I think, anyway, Enterprise is more than an appropriate name.
Yeah, I think as obviously the real-life Enterprise inspired, you know, the Enterprise we see in Star Trek, but we've gotten to the point now, we've gotten so far away from, you know, the actual ship being in service back in the day, and the initial ship we're talking about, and Star Trek has become such a pop culture phenomenon, it's really overshadowed like the real life thing. Like you say, Enterprise, people think of Star Trek, they don't think of, oh, there's a real ship named Enterprise. I bet a lot of people don't even know that. So I find it fascinating to dig deeper into like the real life inspirations for all these things, and that's what the Star Trek Origins kind of series we do is all about. So yeah, let's get into it.
Okay. So when we talk about first of all, there were several ships before World War II that were called Enterprise, from sloops to steamers, all different kinds of vessels.
Yeah, I learned that from Star Trek Generations, Ken.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And now the show comes to a screeching halt. No, we're not going to go down the generations, but yes, that's correct. And anyway, and yet, you know, she was also in, as you saw in Generations, it was spelled with a Z, right? Mm-hmm. For a Z. And so there was Enterprises in the British fleet as well. But in the U.S. fleet, the most famous one to start with, or the most, I guess, the most successful warship in U.S. Navy history was the carrier Enterprise during World War II. She was commissioned in 1936. She was only one of three carriers in the entire fleet that survived World War II, which is pretty fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. And coincidentally, she was a Yorktown class aircraft carrier, the Yorktown being the first of her kind. And, you know, when we think about Star Trek's Enterprise and the Starship Enterprise, you know, we talk about the fact, especially in the TV shows, a lot of victories, right? I mean, she took some hits here and there. But we often talk about how often during the movies that the Enterprise just gets the you-know-what kicked out of her.
Yeah.
You know? And if you look at the World War II carrier, and it was the most highly decorated warship in our history, and she fought in almost every major campaign in the Pacific, she was hit by bombs and torpedoes. She was forced from action many times, and she kept getting upgraded and coming back, kind of like our Enterprise, mm-hmm. right? The Starship Enterprise. A lot of similarities there. And I think that coincides a lot. And I could see where, if you're thinking about what do you name a ship, and if you want this to be your flagship, one that, you know, serves with pride, is very successful in all its campaigns, takes some hits now and then, keeps getting upgraded, keeps coming back. Because think about it. When the TV show aired, the Starship Enterprise, according to the menagerie, what had been in service at that point, almost 18 years. Something like that.
Yeah, it's, if he served with Pike 11 years ago, if you do the math, yeah, it's been at least, you know, around 15 years by that point, yes.
At least, right? Because you had Robert April, who was before him. Mm-hmm. And so the ship had been around, but it had been upgraded. It had been, you know, changed quite significantly. And it had been painted a much brighter red color.
Yes.
On the inside. So I think there's some parallels with that Enterprise and our Enterprise, you know, being what we like to think of as the ship of the line. One of the things that was kind of sad about the aircraft carrier CV-6 Enterprise is that at the end of the war, let me say a couple of things about her. not only was she a survivor of all the major campaigns, she was part of the famous Doolittle raid, you know, the Hornet with the B-25s that flew and attacked Japan from the so-called secret base of Shangri-La. She was out there with her fighter planes protecting the Hornet in case they encountered Japanese shipping. She was the Enterprise was in the famous Battle of Midway. Even before those battles, she was out there patrolling the Hawaiian Islands. She actually came into Pearl Harbor the night of December 7th, so she missed that onslaught by about 12 hours.
Wow.
But several of her planes that were flying back to Pearl Harbor that night were actually shot down because they thought they were enemy aircraft, and people were panicking and shooting at everything.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty interesting that way. And then, you know, she was at Guadalcanal, she was in the Marianas, she was in the Philippine Sea battles, and she was also the first carrier to deploy a dedicated nighttime operations air wing. So she became a night fighting ship, which, you know, is how we do a lot of things today, but she pioneered that. And as the war went on, as I was saying before, they kept adding to her armaments, kept adding to her radars. Again, a lot like the Starship Enterprise, when you think about how it transformed from the TV show to the movies. You know, the new Enterprise was the latest and greatest and had all the bells and whistles on it. So I thought that was kind of cool. But on a sad front, here was the most highly decorated ship of the war. She had been through a lot. She was used after the war ended to ferry the troops home from, you know, from the different islands in the Pacific and also from Europe. And then she pulled into New York Harbor. It was decommissioned late in 1946. And she literally sat in the pier for like 12 years. Mm. There was the intention to buy it and make it a memorial, but the funding just wasn't there. And she was eventually scrapped, just torn apart, which, you know, for such a historical ship, I mean, like I said, you have the Yorktown, which is down in Charleston. You have the Intrepid, which is in New York Harbor. And there are others, you know, here and there, mostly battleships, not so much carriers. But here was the most famous, most efficient, most effective warship in our history, and she was just torn apart.
Sold for scrap, huh? That's tough.
Sold for scrap. They put the ship's bell in the Naval Academy, which was kind of neat. They did take out a couple of the different portholes, and they were used on another ship, actually the new Enterprise. Her stern plate with the name Enterprise on it is now at a baseball park. Hmm. Like a Little League baseball park in New Jersey.
Wow. So that's interesting. You know, although we're talking to go outside of the Star Trek narrative here, it's interesting, you know, you talk about how this was the most famous, you know, ship and most successful ship, and it was turned for scrap. It makes me think back to, you know, the actual sets of the original series, right? You know, they canceled Star Trek, right, and they just unceremoniously threw everything out. I mean, that's crazy. Can you imagine that? Like, can you imagine how much, like, the captain's chair from the original series would be worth today if that survived? And then talking about the portholes, I know that when they made Next Generation, they did save some things from the original series, right? And one of the things they saved was the transporter pads, you know, when you'd walk on it. And so when they built the Next Generation transporter room, they took what had been the bottom transporter pad from the original series and they put them in the top. So you're talking about the portholes there, kind of, and the new Enterprise made me think about that, just on the production side of things, how they did things on Star Trek. So I'm glad a few things survived from that. Because
wow, a few things did, and you know, it's one of those things because you know, I think my love of Star Trek carried over into my love for the Navy and the appreciation of ships, and that was a different era, you know. And they talk a lot about when Harv Bennett took over Star Trek, and of course, you know, the Enterprise took a beating. And then in Star Trek III, Zach's favorite movie.
That's great. Right?
Favorite Star Trek movie. I'm sorry. Yeah. Don't want to overstate it, but yeah, Star Trek III. You know, when they decided to destroy the ship for dramatic purposes, well, Gene Roddenberry was very upset about that. He actually leaked it, I think, to try to get the fans to stop it, much like he leaked the death of Spock, right? And there was a reason for that. I mean, that was an era where people really appreciated and thought more of the ships as being a part of themselves and a part of the family and not just a vessel. And it reminded me when we did our discussion about what was your favorite starship on the Babel conference, which might have been one of the longest threads we ever saw. And it was really engaging, and people were really talking about how much they love their starships and talking about it. And then there were a couple of people that were like, well, what difference does it make as long as it gets them from A to B? And it's like, no!
From A to B to C to D to E, yeah.
That's right. That's right. So I think that's I think that might have been a big reason why they chose the name Enterprise. But there was one other big reason. In 1961, the U.S. commissioned a new Enterprise, CVN 65, not CV 6-A, not CV 6-B, not CVA 6-C.
Is that not a Navy thing? The letters is not from the Navy. Okay, that's completely fabricated by Star Trek, huh?
I don't know if it's fabricated, but it was kind of cool. And I do remember when they were making Next Generation and other shows. For whatever reason, the Enterprise is the only ship that does that, right? I think that was in their guidelines. So, you know, you might come across another ship with Defiant.
Defiant A, right?
Yeah, or any of the other ships that had names that were used before.
Now, so, there was that really wacky registry number on the Yamato in that one episode of Next Generation. Is the fake Yamato? So more silence has least, they go into the void, and mm-hmm. Riker's like, it's 7848. That's incorrect. I don't know what the numbers are. Okay, but it's a bunch of numbers, -E. And I guess whoever wrote that episode, actually it was Jack B. Swords, who wrote Wrath of Khan, wrote that episode, by the way. Trivia.
That's a good one.
But it's like, hey, man, do a little research. I'm sure, like you said, Ken, I'm sure it was in some kind of, you know, the writer's Bible or something about, hey, no other ships get that. And then when they actually do meet the Yamato a few episodes down the road in Contagion, it's a completely different registry number. They corrected that error. So anyway, fanboys have a fun time trying to justify why the registry numbers are different.
One bridge.
One bridge. It's a great moment.
That was one of those times where it's just like, yeah, they really haven't developed Worf too much yet, have they?
But really, see, this is the minutia we love as Star Trek fans. We're talking about registry numbers. So I love it.
Yeah, it's cool. So anyway, so the designation again was CVN 65, C for carrier, V for air wing, N for nuclear. So she was the first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier in the world. And at the time that she was built in 61, she was the largest, most powerful ship in the world. She was 1,180 feet long.
So what is the 5?
65.
But
65 is... the 6 has nothing to do with the 6 from the CV-6.
Okay.
Okay, when they number a carrier and other classes of ship, that means that is the 65th aircraft carrier in the U.S. fleet.
I see.
That had ever been built.
Gotcha.
Okay. The very first one, trivia, was the USS Langley, CV-1.
Okay.
And the original Enterprise aircraft carrier was the 6th one built. And then, jeepers, during World War II all the way through 1960, they built a lot of carriers.
Well, that makes a lot more sense than the crazy way Star Trek numbers its ships. So.
Yeah, it does, but the Navy did not keep up with that tradition of just numbering ships as they went along. Destroyers based on class were changed and things, but carriers still. So they still number the carrier as, you know, from the time they were built, and they just keep on going forward. But like I was saying, in the early 1960s, this was a big deal. Here was the mighty Enterprise. She was the flagship of the U.S. fleet, the biggest, the most powerful ship in the world. So she had a great name. And that's how they kind of recognized the first aircraft carriers. It was an honor to name it Enterprise and to make such a big deal of it. And, you know, she was another thing that kind of put it in common with the Starship Enterprise, more along the lines of the refit Enterprise. Completely different, you know, just complete ship of the line, new engines, so a completely new propulsion, just like the refit, new weapons, new sensors. And at the time of the Enterprise refit, it was the most advanced ship in the fleet, just kind of like the Enterprise was in 1961. But you know what's interesting about this ship, Zach? She lasted over 51 years.
Wow.
So the we talk about how the original Enterprise in the TV show We know that, like we said, by the time the TV show started, that she supposedly has already been in service for 15 years.
It launched into 2240s, is what we've been able to, using some math to figure it out. So it lasted from then until the 2280s, which is approximately 40 years for the original Enterprise. Yeah.
Yeah, so that it's not unheard of. And if capital ships in the Navy can go that long, especially carriers. There's the last few ships that they call it carrying the pennant. The oldest commissioned ship in active service. So the oldest commissioned ship in the Navy's fleet is the USS Constitution in Boston. But obviously she's not an active warship.
See, I was gonna ask you about that, because I know we were talking Yorktown a lot, but the Constitution, I know, was also on Roddenberry's short list for names. And I guess they thought that might have been too American as well, because, you know, the U.S. Constitution, right? I guess that's probably the same thinking.
Yeah, I think so. But they did use the name Constellation, which was a sister ship of the Constitution.
They use Republic as well, so.
Yep, so they've done it. And, of course, those ships have a long and storied name that have followed through, and all were ships during World War II as well. Constellation was also a U.S. aircraft carrier, a pretty good-sized one. She wasn't nuclear, but she was around that same era as the Enterprise. So, yeah, there's some commonalities there. But if you think about it, the refit sailed, what, for 20 years, they said, up until Star Trek III?
Well, see,
you put it all together.
Yeah, they're wrong about that. In Star Trek III, like, that line is incorrect, because he says the Enterprise is 20 years old. Like, no, Star Trek was 20 years old, but the Enterprise by then is 40 years old. If you're doing the refit, if you think the refit happened like in the 2270s, it was like maybe 10 years old, 12 years old by the time of Star Trek III, because there's a big gap, obviously, between motion picture and Wrath of Khan. So, but then, of course, then it gets blown up. But then the Enterprise A gets decommissioned after just a few years. But if that wasn't old, I guess the thinking is that was the original Yorktown that got a refit. So it was really as old as the first Enterprise would have been. So it maybe would have been about 40 years old by then, 50 years, who knows. But then who knows what happened to the B. The C got destroyed, and then there was a huge gap before we got the D. So, you know, looking at how long these starships last, by far, at least as far as we know, by far, the original Enterprise lasted the longest, so.
Yeah, especially if you include the refit years.
Mm-hmm, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, I think had, you know, a piece of metal on her lower secondary hull that was about the only thing that was left from the original Enterprise. Well, I've seen it called a former Yorktown. I've seen it called the Tai Ho. There were all kinds of names. But if you just go by Star Trek V, which makes me cringe, but not as bad as Generations.
Agreed.
It was a ship that was rapidly put together, and that's why it just wasn't working right. So if it had been a well sailed, you know, long in service ship, it wouldn't have performed that way. So I think the true canon piece of that is that the ship was built from scratch. It might have had a different designation, maybe like the Yorktown, the carrier Yorktown. The Enterprise got destroyed. They renamed it Enterprise in honor of that ship, and off they go. And rather than, you know, buy a whole new model or whatever, here you know, slap an A on it and you're off to the races.
Let's see what she's got.
Let's see what she's got. So anyway, the CVN 65 Enterprise, like I said, she served for 50 years. She was involved off the Vietnam War. She was involved in some scraps in the Middle East. She was involved in Desert Storm, the Afghanistan War, the Iraq War. She had a long and storied history of good service, and it was a beautiful ship. I had seen it before in Norfolk a few times. And it took a while, because her last voyage was in 2012, and it took 3 to 4 years for them to get all the fuel out of the reactors, you know, to defuel the ship. And so now, and I've posted it on my own Facebook page, so you can go take a look. There's a couple of different articles that I posted a few weeks back when they officially decommissioned her. So she is now being towed away, just like her predecessor, for scrap.
So I had a question about how often do they have to go into like dry dock to get like just upkeep on these ships, you know? Because if they're staying in the water, they're like, there's a certain amount of time they have to get out of the water and repair? Like, well, is there some kind of circulation cycle of X amount of years? Well, what is that? I'm just curious. And I'm sure many of the listeners are too. So,
yeah, you know, I think every 12 to 18 months, she'll go into dry dock. Some of it might just be for more routine maintenance. But, you know, sensors, technology, things change. Radars, communications. The ships will always, when they come in off a cruise, so deployment schedules used to be pretty consistent, 6 months on, 6 months off for Navy vessels, and then, you know, maybe an 18-month refit at so far after they reach a certain point in their life. And that's changed a lot. Shrinking military budgets, trying to get more out of the ships. They've pushed them. The voyages now can go as long as 8 to 9 months to sea with a faster turnaround. But the ships are really taking a beating nowadays more than they used to. But there was a point, I don't know what year it was, where the Enterprise went through SLEP. That's S-L-E-P, the Ship Life Extension Program, where they upgraded everything. You know, they upgraded the racks, the bedding, the radars, the flight deck, you name it. You know, if you go online and you look at pictures of the Enterprise from the time she was commissioned till the time she was decommissioned, she had a very distinct looking island. But you can see where they made modifications along the way, different sensors, different radars. It's pretty cool actually, and you can see that they're constantly upgrading and changing. You know, this was a ship that didn't need fuel, right? It was nuclear powered, but they did have to refuel the reactors after, I want to say, 10 or 15 years, something along those lines. That's how long that was good for. So it's had an incredible life to it and a storied history. But I think it's kind of cool that the USS Enterprise CVN-65 was commissioned 4 years before Star Trek came on. Or I should say 3 years, excuse me, 61, 64, right? And then she outlasted all of the Star Trek series and movies because she was just decommissioned a few weeks ago.
The prime time was the prime Enterprise right there.
That's right. She beat them all, man.
That's
she
nice.
Beat them all. Yeah. So, so now that she has been decommissioned, the good news is there will be another USS Enterprise.
As there always is.
As there always is. So right after they announced that they were decommissioning the Enterprise, they announced that one of the newer aircraft carriers, a Ford-class carrier, will bear the name Enterprise. Her number will be CVN-80.
Gotcha. The 80th.
Yeah.
All that. See, now I can look at these ships and understand all the numbering means, Ken. So thank you. So it's crazy. So this ship is going to launch in the early 2020s, they said. Which really makes you feel like we are living in the future. Because, I mean, even me, who I love reminding you is much younger than you, Ken. Even for me, the the year 2000 is like the future, right? In the year 2000. All right, Conan O'Brien had this kid in the year 2000. And then it's funny, they continued it after the year 2000, which was just hilarious. But you say the early 2020s, like, wow, we're really getting close to the actual Star Trek future. You know, First Contact is just, you know, just 60 years away, 50 years away, right? So 2063. So it's crazy to see that, like, in print, in black and white right there. The new Enterprise will launch in 2020. It makes you feel like I'm reading some fake Star Trek encyclopedia article and not the real world, right?
Yeah. Well, it is something. And, you know, I remember as a kid, and they used to have pictures of, you know, what the fleet would look like, the Navy fleet would look like. And while if you want to see some cool pictures, look up the USS Zumwalt, and you'll see a pretty cool, very futuristic destroyer that they've just built and a class of destroyers. It is really far out space nuts looking. But the, basically not a lot has changed. And it's kind of like the changes in the generations of starships, right? Still, it's changed, but even the basic shapes and designs, those very distinct Federation-looking starships, even in the JJ verse, they haven't really changed much at all, right?
I mean, right.
Circle, neck, secondary hull, engines.
And if you're an Excelsior or Miranda class, you can just last forever, so.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's the beautiful thing, because you know, as we like to tell our nice Earl Grey friends, man, you know, for a show that was successful, they really mined the heck out of those movies. Yeah.
Well, you know, but that if you look at talking about how long these Navy ships last, that's completely realistic for those ships to last 70, 80 years, assuming they're being taken care of. They go through the regular baryon sweeps, as we learned in Next Generation, get those every few years, right? Then they're in good shape. So that's it's interesting that the more you learn about like how the real Navy works, the more like Star Trek kind of works as well. It's always this connection between the two of them. And as you said, you know, the whole Nicholas Meyer and Harv Bennett, you know, kind of their era of Star Trek was the most Navy of them all. But that influence can be felt even all the way down through the Next Generation and the rest of the 24th century shows that so many new incarnations look back to, even as, you know, we go in the Kelvin timeline. I'm sure Discovery, I'm very interested to see what Discovery has the same kind of, if they're going to go for like the naval feel or anything like that, because it takes place in an earlier time, of course. So, I mean, even, you know, the sets of Enterprise, which was, you know, a prequel to TOS, it looked very, you know, submarine-esque and everything's cramped and there's pipes and people are, you know, kneeling down, right, and that kind of thing. So just across the board, organizationally, visually, you know, structural, command structure-wise, you know, the Navy has had a serious influence on Star Trek, and no more so than the Enterprise itself, right?
Yeah, which is ironic because, you know, the show was created by an Army guy or an Army Air Force guy,
Gene
Roddenberry. Yeah, so, you know, it is just kind of interesting, and you know, how people kind of follow along. But that tells you, though, you know, in a different era, how closely these things were followed, right? I mean, It was just a big deal. There was an arms race on back then, and there was some prestige in being the first and the biggest, like the Enterprise was, the CVN-65. That was a big deal back then, right? Because, you know, you had your bad guy Soviet Union that were building huge fleets too, but they couldn't match the technology or the scale of the Enterprise. Right. And that ship, while by the time it was decommissioned, it was no longer the largest. It had maintained it as the longest. It just wasn't as heavy as a lot of the new carriers that had been built in the 50 years since she was built. But their propulsion's the same. But, you know, you made an excellent point, Zach, that during the Next Generation, and especially Deep Space Nine, you saw a lot of old starships.
Yeah.
And you're right. They do last. And if you think about it, even though the propulsion has changed in terms of, you know, nuclear power versus steam or gas turbine or something that they use in the fleet, they still just turn a propeller, right? So, you know, interesting, like in Relics, when they talk about, you know, impulse engine technology is still pretty much the same. You know, they hadn't changed a lot of things. So they can do, they're more efficient, and the ships can go, I guess, a bit faster, with maybe not the same size engines that they needed during the original series era. But it does kind of mirror the fleet in that sense. You know, ships can last longer, and even the new ones, they keep basically the same standard shape and this basic same way of doing things, just like the Navy does. I mean, ships from World War II, they're not as streamlined as ships from today, but, you know, some of them could still pack quite a wallop. In fact, we have never duplicated battleships. Never. Or their firepower to this day. So it's kind of impressive.
And there's no families on board, are there, Ken?
Oh, good God, no.
But I'm sure if there were, they would separate the ship into two parts, right, to ensure the family safety whenever they went to dangerous situations, right? That seems to be the logical thing.
Yeah,
to do.
Yeah. Usually when a Navy ship separates in two parts, that just means the one part is sinking by the bow and one is sinking by the stern.
Time for CVN 81 at that point.
Yeah, it's a bad day. But it is an interesting discussion, like I said, how you could have that kind of continuity, mm-hmm, and how it could follow. Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Well, if you look at a layman like myself, right, you look at a ship from like a World War II archival footage, and you look at the right news today, like, look, a ship off the coast of wherever. I'm like, well, that looks pretty much the same to me. Like, I can tell, like, well, there's a bigger gun turret on there, and the planes on the aircraft carrier are more advanced. But to, you know, to the everyday guy like myself, it's like, yeah, that's a ship. That is a military boat, right? That is all I see. So it is interesting, you know, you point out that back in the day when these things were coming out, when the second Enterprise carrier came out in the 60s, people were really tuned into this stuff. People would gravitate towards these names and know them. And, you know, I guess that just, that goes to a lot of things. You know, I think we're so permeated with so much else in our, you know, pop culture environment or just news or anything. You kind of, this stuff gets lost in the shuffle unless you're like kind of tuned into it like you are, Ken. Like, I don't think a lot of people are like, oh, did you hear about the new Enterprise? It's coming out in 2020, right? No one really talks about that, much in the same way people don't talk about NASA anymore, right? I mean, because back in the, again, the 60s, you know, people were like, oh yeah, the Apollo 11, I can't, you know, people were excited. They knew astronauts' names. These guys were celebrities, like much like the generals were, that they named all these ships off of, after, I should say. So it's just the, just an observation, not saying good or bad. It's just how far we've, you know, drifted away from being plugged into all this stuff, right?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of national pride back then about it, because it was a literal arms race, right? There was the perceived bad guy in the Soviet Union, and we wanted to be a big deterrent. So we just kept kind of out technologying one or the other with bigger, better ships, or like you've pointed out to NASA, it was a space race, right? I mean, the Russians were the first in space, and the Americans were the first on the moon. And there was, you know, when the shuttle was coming out, that was a huge deal, because something reusable and going up into outer space, and people followed it closely because it was, again, it was a piece of national pride. And now, you know, there's kind of a different feel out there. It just is, you know, there isn't quite that same feel. Or if you do have that feeling towards it, you can be labeled bad things. So it's
well, you know, I tell people, it's like, why haven't we gone back to the moon? I'm like, well, if North Korea plans to go to the moon, maybe we'll go back, right? Like that's the kind of, you know, inspiration we need to get there first. But I mean, it's all politically. Yes, there's obviously scientific and, you know, and the manifest destiny of mankind and all that is going for us when we like go explore the moon and Mars. But I mean, that's why we got our butts in gear and went to the moon, because the Russians were going to go, right? And that's, and so, and now that we're like the masters of space, the United States are like, all right, we've done it, been there, done that. Let's orbit in a space station for the next 30 years around Earth, right? I mean, NASA's just, I love NASA. I live down the street from NASA, okay? It's just not as exciting to the general public, and I totally understand why, because it's like, well, what are you guys doing up there? Well, we grew some grass, and we tested the zero gravity effects on mice, and, you know, we're doing some really interesting stuff. Like, that doesn't excite people with that kind of national pride you're talking about, Ken. So here we are in the...
Yeah, but I also think it could be a unifying force. You know, one of the great things about landing on the moon, not that the United States did it first, but it was the way they did it. You know, they didn't say this is a giant leap for the United States. They said for all mankind. Uh-huh. And I think those are the things that could inspire and draw us together. And I think the space shuttle did that to a large degree. Uh-huh. As you're probably too young to remember, but when they were building it, it was an international effort, right? If you see some pictures of the Columbia when she's extending the arm out of the shuttle, right? It has a Canadian flag on it. Or you'll see that different astronauts from around the world flew on it, just like the International Space Station. I would love to see a joint, you know, united approach to launching men's and women's, excuse me if I'm, you know, ones.
Hey, we're a TOS podcast, ones, here, forgive us, okay?
That's right, yeah. One's journey to Mars would be so exciting, right? I mean, it really would. And I think, you know, because, you know, we've conquered the moon in that sense, what's the next big step? You know, wouldn't it be cool? And because of TV shows and the way our you know, we can get pulled into virtual reality, we forget how important it is to stay real.
Excellent, right? Excellent point, Ken. Well said.
We got to stay focused, because if you're going to put that lens over your face and just pretend, what a waste.
It's too true, Ken, too true. No, this has been a fascinating, you know, kind of history lesson to the legacy of the name Enterprise. You know, I mean, in Star Trek, obviously Enterprise, never forget the name Enterprise, right? That's a big deal in Star Trek. But in the real world, that has such a equal legacy, really. And if, you know, just relatively to the military here, and that's something that gets lost in the history books, and people aren't really tuning into those things anymore. And it's fun to explore that and how it influenced such a widespread social phenomenon like Star Trek. You know, these are the reason why Star Trek was so successful is it tapped into stuff that was in the real world and extrapolated it in a fictional sense. But I mean, it had a solid core basis in reality, and that's great. I mean, that it's coming from truth, so that's why it's so powerful, right?
I think so. There was a lot of great things that the name Enterprise had accomplished by the time Star Trek aired. You know, the first surface ship to circle the Earth without having to refuel, and the other one being the one that held the line for a long time while the U.S. fleet was decimated and needed to be built back up, and you know, just was one of just a very few ships to actually carry on the fight and did it nobly and well. And, you know, actually took place in the battle that turned the whole course of the war in Midway. So, yeah, there's a lot to Enterprise history that's out there. You don't just have to be a fan of naval warfare or history. You could be a fan of technology and look at a lot of the firsts that were established on the CVN-65 and some of the new technologies that are going to be incorporated on the CVN-80. It's going to keep on going. And so you can actually tap into kind of the fantasy piece and the Star Trek, and you know, because we're always cheering for the Enterprise and we want it to be the coolest and the best ship in the world. And at the same time, you could kind of look at today and what's going on and saying, oh, okay, you know, by the time this thing launches, what are its capabilities? What is it going to be able to do? You know, and if you also look at a lot of the cruises and the missions of the CVN-65 over the 51 years, and you can find it all online. You'll be amazed too how many more humanitarian type missions it was actually on than warfighting. In fact, most of its career was just that, right? They would train for war, but they were out there bringing relief to earthquake victims and Indonesia and the Philippines and different places that were hit by hurricanes or typhoon. Just it's an incredible legacy of doing a lot of what you would say humanitarian good missions. The real true purpose of our Enterprise on Star Trek, which one day we hope that all of our ships will be carrying out, not to drop bombs necessarily on bad guys, but to bring food to those that need it, or equipment or supplies to help people survive. And you'll be happy to know that Enterprise did that probably as often as our fictional one did.
Wow. Well said, Ken. Can't add any more to that. Well said. But the history of the Enterprise isn't the only thing we're discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Was the BBC wrong in doing this? Not under the auspices that this is a kid's show and showing it during, you know, when kids would be watching. Because if you think about it, there's 75 other episodes that they did show, some with some minor editing, which I think would have been appropriate.
The 602 Club.
Going back to the Gotham thing really quickly, I know this is semi-derailing. Why would you want to move to Gotham? I mean, he has to have been there. It's like the picture that he has on his wall is this beautiful, shining, like daytime view, if I'm not mistaken, of Gotham, which I don't think we ever see. It was like, I'm not really sure. Charm City looks quite nice. Like,
so. Literary Treks.
But still, at the same time, you're left with that what if, you know? And I know that, like, the Parallels episode gives you a couple of brief glimpses of Riker in command after Picard is dead, and it doesn't seem to be going well for Mr. Riker at that point.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at trek.fm, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. You can find Richard at rut8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at geekfilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre, post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at Boston SCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s, and we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone, and join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.